So heuristically, this outer apparent horizon is sort of the limit of outer trap surfaces. And the presence of this apparent horizon signals, the existence of such an apparent horizon signals the presence of a black hole. And then Hawking's theorem can be stated for apparent horizons. So let sigma be an outer trap surface in V3 in a spacetime M4 obeying the dominant energy the dominant energy condition. Then sigma is topologically S2 generically.
You want to say outer apparent horizon.
Outer apparent horizon. Thanks, Dan. Then sigma is an S2 topologically, at least generically. The T2 still arises as a borderline case. This theorem actually includes the previous theorem, because in the stationary case, that section of the event horizon qualifies as an outer apparent horizon.
Asymptotically flat, M4, what no?
Here?
Restriction
on M4. No, because, so, all that stuff that you needed in the previous theorem is built into the requirement that there are no outer trap surfaces. That's what the asymptotically flat gives you in the black hole stationary case. The previous theorem. So this just sort of builds it in, localizes the statement of the theorem, and this is really the version we will concentrate on. The proof is quite similar, but now you have to carry out the variation in the space-like hypersurface V3. And so again, you have this family of surfaces, sigma t. Each has a null expansion function, theta t, with respect to the outward normal. Again, we're assuming this is a marginally trapped surface, so it's the same theta 0. Again, now you need a formula for d theta dt again. You're not going down this null hypersurface. You're out the space-like hypersurface. So there's the formulas are similar, but a little different. But anyway, under the appropriate assumptions, you again show that that derivative is negative. Okay. So we want to consider generalizations of this result to higher dimensions. Yes?
Could you say a couple of words why you get this derivative negative? I mean, I can see why you can get this derivative negative on average, when you average over the sigma. But how do you get it point-wise?
Well, there's...
There's a torsion. There is a torsion in that formula. And if torsion is not equal to...
Actually, I'll be writing down the explicit formula, and we'll actually look at it.
Okay.
In this lower dimensional case, Gauss-Bonnet plays an important role in showing that.
Yeah.
But it's point-wise, not integrated. Point-wise. So we want to consider higher dimensional version of this theorem, before doing that, I want to just mention that there's a completely different approach to the study of the topology of black holes via topological censorship. So I will try to make a very long story short.
Greg, so this statement is new in this generality, or this was already known in your previous work?
Yes, so in Hawking and Ellis, it's the original result about stationary black holes.
Right, but you don't assume stationary here.
And this version involving apparent horizons is presented in Hawking's Lesouche article on black holes. In fact, Hawking attributes or gives credit to Gibbons for pointing out that this apparent horizon version of Hawking's argument works.
So this should be called the Gibbons Hawking.
Yeah, let's call it Gibbons Hawking's. Hawking Gibbons. I talked to Gary about this week. And well, Gary is very modest. He wasn't taking much credit, but anyway. Yeah, so there is an alternative approach to studying black hole topology via topological. Let me save this somehow. Oh well. Via topological censorship. This was a topic developed in the 90s by a number of people. Friedman, Schleich, Witt, Woolgar, myself, and certainly contributions from others, including the organizers of this session. And the original paper on the topic was a paper of Friedman, Schleich, and Witt, and the four of us wrote several subsequent papers. As the name implies, topological censorship has something to do with cosmic censorship, and in fact, it's a consequence of cosmic censorship. And the basic idea is this. We know in GR, non-trivial topological structures, handles, wormholes, tend to pinch off and form singularities. Non-trivial topological structures tend to induce gravitational collapse. And in the process of collapse, an event horizon forms, and that topology ends up hidden behind the event horizon. So there is it's out of view from external observers. There's no naked topology. Okay. And so from the point of view of topological censorship, the topology of the domain of outer communications, the topology of the region outside all black holes and white holes, if there are those present, should somehow be simple. And there are a number of results along these lines. And let me give you perhaps the most basic one. So this may be viewed as a theorem on topological censorship. Let M be a four-dimensional, asymptotically flat space-time, obeying the null energy condition. So you get a weaker energy condition coming in, null energy instead of dominant energy. And suppose, let me draw a picture. Let's draw it over here. Scry plus, scry minus. There is a scry minus. Here's the future event horizon. Maybe this past event horizon if there are white holes. And asymptotically flat, again, means you have a regular scry. In particular, regular topology. And here's the domain of outer communications here. And suppose that the domain of outer communications, call it D, which is the time-like past of scry plus intersect the time-like future of scry minus. Suppose D is globally hyperbolic. So the global hypervelocity assumption on the domain of outer communications, that's where you're building in cosmic censorship. No naked singularities out there in the DOC. Then, the domain of outer communications is simply connected. Okay. So topological censorship works at the fundamental group level. Of course, I'm not going to talk about the proof here, but I just want to illustrate how this result can be used to get information about the topology of the event horizon or cross sections of the event horizon, very briefly. So, well, I guess I will repeat this picture. So we want to say something about the topology of the cross sections of E. We take a cut, a two-sphere cut, say on scry minus, and we look at the future of that cut within the domain of outer communications. And so that gives you a subregion here within the domain of outer communications. And you can show just as well that this subregion is globally hyperbolic and simply connected. So since it's globally hyperbolic, it has a Cauchy surface. And so here's a Cauchy surface, call it V. And since this subregion is simply connected, all the topologies in the Cauchy surface, that means the Cauchy surface is simply connected. And now take the closure of V within the full spacetime. And when you take the closure of V within the full spacetime, if things are nice enough, you pick up a cross section of the event horizon.
Concern that the closure of V might be rather ill-defined.
It could be rather bad. It could, in principle, be rather bad. But under, you know.
Well, having
I do care. So this is an assumption. Okay. Suppose.
So I'm assuming there's some sort of compactified, sensible.
Yeah. When you take the closure, it's not running up and down the horizon. You just get. So this manifold with boundary must also be simply connected. And that implies that the boundary component is simply connected. It's a two-sphere. Okay. So this is the topological version of Hawking's theorem. Has some advantages. Doesn't require stationary. These are in principle dynamical horizons. Has a weaker energy condition, the null energy condition. But it's more global. It really does require more structure about scry, in particular, that it has this topology.
And you don't need to use the word generic here. It just that way.
Right. You don't need the word generic here. That's right. Now, in fact, this theorem that this argument makes use of holds in arbitrarily high dimensions. Topological censorship holds in all dimensions. As long as scry is simply connected, the DOC will be simply connected. In fact, the more general statement about topological censorship is that at the fundamental group level, the topology of the DOC is no more complicated than the topology of the boundary. So at first blush, this looks like maybe we can use topological censorship to get information about black holes in higher dimensions. But in fact, you can't use it. And the problem is that only when the dimension is low enough, only when the spatial dimension is 3, does the bulk space being simply connected imply that the boundary is simply connected. Once you move up to spatial dimension 4 or higher, the fundamental group of the bulk does not determine the fundamental group of the boundary. So you can't use topological censorship.
Are there no restrictions at all, or is there?
There are no restrictions. In fact, there are corbodisms between. Well, of course, there's curvature. There's energy conditions that might, but at the pure topological level, there are corbodisms between the three sphere and any three manifold, where in between the thing is simply connected. So topological censorship doesn't help here. So this part of the talk was sort of a red herring, but I've really had a chance to ever talk about topological censorship, so I took an opportunity to fit it in here. So what we really want to do is...
Could you just, in one sentence, the main idea of the theorem, that's the top word there, can you put it in one sentence?
No. Invite me to Duke. No.
You're invited.
So what I really want to do is, it's still here. I really want to go back to this setting for Hawking's theorem about apparent horizons, but in higher dimensions. So sort of starting over here. No, it's not hard, but we can talk about it afterwards. So here's our setting. We have an n plus one dimensional space-time, n greater than or equal to 3. We have an n-dimensional space-like hypersurface. In mn plus 1. And sigma n minus 1 is n minus 1 dimensional hypersurface in Vn. And so just the same setup as here, except in higher dimensions. And we again closed compact without boundary. And we again assume that, so here's Vn, sigma n minus 1. And again, we assume that sigma separates the space-like hypersurface into an outside and an inside. And let me just introduce a little bit of notation. Let U be the unit time-like normal to the hypersurface. Let N be the outward unit normal of sigma within V. And then along sigma, we define the null normal vector field U plus N. And with respect to that null normal vector field, we can look at the expansion of sigma. So first we look at just introduce some notation. The null second fundamental form of sigma with respect to this outer null normal K, and denoting that by chi, it's a bilinear form on the tangent spaces of sigma defined by chi of xy is the derivative of k in the direction x dotted into y. Okay. And then, so this is the null second fundamental form. The expansion is the trace of the null second fundamental form. So you can write something like this, GAB, chi AB, where A and B are coordinates on the surface. This is really the divergence of the vector field K along divergence along sigma. And then oh, this is just what I need. Okay, except in higher dimensions. So we have the notion of outer apparent horizon again. So we say sigma n minus 1 is an outer apparent horizon. Provided outer apparent horizon, provided sigma is an outer marginally trapped surface, that is theta equals 0, and there are no outer trapped surfaces n minus 1 dimensional surfaces outside of sigma. So it's the same notion as before. And then the theorem that Rick and I have proved is the following. So Mn plus 1 be a space-time satisfying the dominant energy condition. If sigma n minus 1 is an outer apparent horizon in Vn, then sigma n minus 1 is positive Imami. Admits a metric of positive scalar curvature. It's a metric of positive scalar curvature unless there's the borderline case, unless sigma is Ricci flat. So if we were in a space-time dimension of 4 or 5, in space-time dimension 5, sigma would be three-dimensional, and so Ricci flat would mean flat. The null second fundamental form vanishes, of course, on sigma. And the relevant energy momentum tensor term, here's the energy momentum tensor contracted with UA, U and K, vanishes on sigma. So again, the conclusion here is, in higher dimensions, that generically the apparent horizon is positive Umami.
A restriction on dimension.
No restriction on dimension.
And greater or equal to 3.
So in 5 dimensions, how restrictive that is? Is there a least which?
Well, right. Then it's flat, and of course, you know, you have a complete classification of flat things.
No, not the unless case. I mean, the just positive Miyamabe.
Oh yeah.
There's a
So I'm unfortunately running out of time, but I did want to make a few comments about this. Of course, there's. All a tremendous number of results about topological obstruction to positive Umabi. To existence of positive scalar curvature metrics. Beginning with the famous Lishnero-Witz. Is that acceptable? Thank you. Concerning the vanishing of the A roof genus. But of course, there was a big breakthrough in discovery of topological obstructions, of course, in the 80s by Shane Yao and Gromov Lawson. Pardon? Well, close enough. I'm rounding up. Okay. As we know, tori don't admit metrics of positive scalar curvature. Tori connected some compact manifolds don't admit. But let me concentrate on the case of space-time dimension 5. That is dimension of our apparent horizon 3. Let me. Concentrate on the case of three-dimensional apparent horizon. And then we know by prime decomposition theorem so we're assuming sigma's compact and orientable. Sigma can be expressed as a connected sum of spherical spaces, homotopy three spheres, perhaps with identifications, or if Poincaré is two, three spheres. Perhaps with identifications, finite number of copy of S2 cross S1s, and then connect some with k pi 1 manifolds. K pi 1s are manifolds whose universal cover is contractible, like tori. And the results of Shane Yao, however, the results of Shane Yao, Gromov Lawson show that if sigma emits a metric of positive scalar curvature, then you cannot have k pi 1s in the prime decomposition. So if sigma is positive umabi, it must be a connected sum of spherical spaces and S2 cross S1s. And
those admit.
I'm sorry?
And conversely, those admit metrics.
And yes, right, so it's basically a classification. Well, I called spherical spaces homotopy three spheres. And of course, Harvey and Emperon's example fits very well into this because theirs is S2 cross S1. What I'm wondering is, can you have a black hole with apparent horizon, or stationary black hole with cross sections of the event horizon, be a connected sum of two handles, two S2 cross S1s? Is there a gluing construction, Jim, for S2 cross S1s? For gluing construction for black holes? I don't know. So
the more general question that's of course open is whether any metric, which admitting a metric, any manifold admitting a metric of positive scalar curvature can arise in some higher horizon.
Yeah. That's right. So far, only S2 cross S1. Is that correct?
But you're saying that T3 could occur actually as an exceptional case in this list.
Yeah. So we're only talking. Yeah. So this is only when we're really in positive. Oh, Can you have a T3? No, I mean, I don't think so. I mean, there are T3 examples. Well, you can, if you're just talking about apparent horizons, you can cook up artificial examples, even somewhat less artificial examples. Gannon had one a long time ago with tori. But not if it's really, if you're going to throw in asymptotically flat, and if you're talking about genuine black hole spacetimes, which are asymptotically flat, I don't think you can have a T3.
So the conjecture then is, if you have an asymptotically flat spacetime, then the sigma being Ricci flat, et cetera, this doesn't happen.
Yeah, under suitable global assumptions, this case doesn't happen. Matter of fact, to tell you the truth, I mean, this is something actually that I've worked on and more or less settled in the time symmetric case. When you're in the torus case, the expectation here is you get a lot of rigidity. This is just infinitesimal rigidity, statement along sigma. I think you get a lot more rigidity than that. And actually, in the time symmetric case, Kai and I have proved some results about least area T2s. Got to get splitting or something like that. And maybe that happens here. So you'll get...
If you put in the word generic again, you can rule out those unless cases there. Yeah, so.
Right. So generically, we're in generically we're in positive Umabi. What about the proof? Can I have 5 minutes?
Yeah.
I need 15, but, right. but I'll take 5.
Yeah. As long as you don't ask for just 5 at a time.
Well, actually, at this point is where I was going to flash some slides up. Well, I've run out of time.
You can use them on the sides because I don't know how to lower the. It won't help.
But of course, this would have been faster, I suppose. This is probably not a good idea. So, you know, what we need to do in this theorem is to produce a metric of positive scalar curvature. And in some sense, it's the same old game. You want to do it by a conformal rescaling. The thing is, how do you come up with the scale factor? And in the beginning, the proof proceeds more or less along the lines of Hawking's argument. So we consider. Here's our sigma n minus 1. We again consider a variation. A one parameter deformation of sigma corresponding to t equals 0. And we want to consider normal variations. So having variation vector field. Which is sort of the first derivative here at t equals 0 of the variation, equal to phi times n. So n is the outward normal to sigma. And phi is any smooth function on sigma. So we consider normal variations of this type. And it's a fact, normal variations, so the variation is really determined by this function phi on sigma, what rate you're pulling away from sigma. And it's a fact using the assumption that there are no outer trap surfaces outside of sigma, that there exists such a variation with phi strictly positive, having d theta dt, well, there's no trapped at t equals 0, having d theta dt greater than or equal to 0. It's important to have phi strictly positive here in the argument. In the time symmetric case, Kai and I observed this, and in the non-time symmetric case, it follows from work of Anderson, Mars, and Simone. So I've got a very, I got a normal variation with a strictly positive function phi, and what we need is this formula for d theta dt. And let me flash that up. I think I can actually, well, doesn't leave much time for questions. Finish in 3 minutes. is that readable? Not very?
If we cut the lights, it should be.
Oh. So this is the formula for, I know it's not so much fun to look at other people's formulas, but this is the formula I derived for d theta dt at t equals 0 a number of years ago. Of course, a lot of people have made this computation over the years, beginning with Hawking. But either they use Newman-Penrose, which I don't understand, or the situation is slightly different. So in the end, you just have to do it yourself. But I am comfortable with the fact that this is correct. In particular, Anderson, Mars, and Simone have to do the same computation in their paper, and they agree. So, now this expression here, all the terms, all the functions, all the operators, Laplacian, and so on. These are all things on sigma. And so what we have here is a differential expression in the function phi. This quantity Q is a nice quantity from the point of view of this game of conformal deformations. It's the scalar curvature of sigma, and then two terms with signs. This is the energy momentum tensor contracted on U and K, and this is the square of the null second fundamental form along sigma. Since theta vanishes, that's really the shear squared. And this vector field X, well, it's really not important what it is, but it involves the second fundamental form or extrinsic curvature of V. And in the time symmetric case, X vanishes, and so all these X terms vanish, and what you end up with is exactly the stability operator for minimal surface theory. In the time symmetric case, this reduces to the stability operator in minimal surface theory acting on phi, and this is exactly what one expects to have. So this expression on the right-hand side is sort of the generalization. This is actually linear in phi when you multiply those, when you square out. But this is the generalization of the stability operator in the non-time symmetric case.
What is
phi? What is? Okay, of course, it's not important what x is, but that means this is a vector field in V3. It could point out into V3, and then you project into sigma, because every P is projection into sigma. So it's tangent. That everything is then defined on sigma. Well, we make a transformation. We let U be ln phi, and then this expression on the right-hand side becomes this expression here. This bad positive terms, negative terms are good, this bad positive term actually cancels out. And since d theta dt must be greater than or equal to 0 in this variation, there's no outer trap things, you actually get this inequality in U. And at this point, we can recover Hawking's theorem. Because if you integrate this inequality, you know, divergence goes away, Laplacian goes away, and you see that the integral of Q is non-negative. But if you go up and look and see what Q is, that says the integral of the scalar curvature on sigma is non-negative. So when space-time is dimension 4, sigma is dimension 2, you have Gauss-Monnet theorem telling you that's got to be genus 0 or 1. And if it's genus 1, if you look at all those, don't throw away those terms with signs, you get all this vanishing stuff. And in fact, this is essentially what Hawking's argument was. But what to do in higher dimensions? The fact that the integral scalar curvature is non-negative doesn't give you much information in higher dimensions. Well, okay. What we do here not, this will be done in 1 minute. We, this Laplacian term, that's div grad, that Laplacian term can actually be absorbed into the divergence term. I wouldn't have thought of doing that, but except for these hints from Shainyo too. And so you have, once you absorb that Laplacian term and the divergence term, you have this inequality, and just set y equal to x minus grad u, and then you have this inequality here. Now at this point, a miracle occurs. You multiply through this inequality by an arbitrary function, psi squared on sigma, and you do an estimate here, an estimate. This inequality has a certain structure that certain important inequalities in Shainyo 2 has, and this estimate, this type of estimate appears there. You integrate by parts, Schwartz, etc., and integrate, and the result is that you actually have an inequality on psi, integrated inequality for arbitrary function psi on sigma. Now, if you played this rescaling game, you're familiar with this rescaling game, once you have this inequality, you know you're home free. You look at this equation here, minus Laplacian psi plus q psi, you look at the corresponding eigenvalue problem. The significance of this inequality, it tells us that the first eigenvalue is greater than or equal to zero. You can choose a positive eigenfunction for it, and if g is the metric on sigma, you multiply by this expression involving the eigenfunction, and you end up with a metric of non-negative scalar curvature. And unless special things happen, it's got to be strictly positive. And that's the proof. And thank you very much, and I'm sorry for running so late.
Well, we actually had lots of questions and comments during your talk, but there's a quick one or two.
So I this would all look very familiar if this were the conformal Laplacian, but it's not, right?
Okay. Yeah, good question. Of course, you can fix this up to be like the conformal Laplacian. You know, just that constant, you're probably...
Times the richest given.
The T and the null second formal form term. I mean, it's not the Q is not just scalar curvature.
No, but if you go through the argument, what you really need is just those terms to be non-negative. The ambient, what you're really using is the ambient scalar is non-negative. Any terms being non-negative will do in the argument. They only help you.
So the critical point in the whole argument is that there are no outward trapped surfaces outside sigma. What happens, that doesn't exclude the possibility that there might be an outer trapped surface which is outside sigma, part of it, and part of the inside.
Yeah.
Does that cause any problem? That possibility is there
That's okay. That doesn't cause a problem, right? That does not cause a problem. Just as there can't be one strictly outside. What happens is you look at this stability operator and if this is violated, the thing is you can look at the stability operator has a principal eigenvalue, and if that principal eigenvalue is negative, then you really can produce a deformation that produces strictly trapped outside.
Maybe one last question. Do you think you can obtain more stringent restrictions if you assume stationarity?
Well, I don't have any real feelings about that. Certainly in the stationary case, of course, I wouldn't expect to have the special cases. No, I haven't really thought about that question at all. What extra mileage you can get out of stationary. Because yeah. This argument, of course, is really a local argument. Yeah.
All right, thanks very much.
Thank you.